Good morning. We have the good fortune this year of having the longest possible Christmas season. Season, of course, always begins on Christmas. It ends on the Sunday after January the 6th, which most of the world celebrates as the Feast of the Epiphany. Well, obviously, you get the most mileage out of that when the Epiphany itself is on a Sunday, as it is this year. So whenever Christmas is on a Tuesday, we have the longest Christmas season of all. Next year it'll be a little shorter and a little shorter until the cycle begins over again. That gives us plenty of time to marinate ourselves in the mystery of the Word become flesh. And today's gospel presents another aspect, another dimension to that mystery, to think about, pray about, settle into, provided we ask the right questions. We need to realize that this is unlikely to be history. First of all, it's certainly not out of character for Herod to do such a thing, but it's not recorded anywhere else. Not only is it not mentioned in any of the other three Gospels, it's not mentioned in any of the other chronicles of the time, several of which take some pains to record long lists of Herod's atrocities, but this is not among them. Well, if it's not history, why do we have it? Why does Matthew tell the story this way? Well, he has certain facts he has to account for. He has to work into his narrative. He knows from history, from tradition that's been passed down, that Jesus was born in Bethlehem, and that he was raised in Nazareth. Somehow he has to put those two together. Luke does it by starting them out in Nazareth and getting them down to Bethlehem for the birth by means of this census. Matthew does it the other way. They live in Bethlehem. They have a house there. The Magi enter the house and find the babe with Mary, his mother. How does he get them to Nazareth? Well, we have this whole story, and they go off to Egypt, and they come back from Egypt, and they're afraid to go back to Bethlehem because Herod's son is reigning there, so they go on to Nazareth. So it works in terms of making the story work. But it goes farther than that. Both infancy narratives are overtures to their gospel. They start already explaining a whole bunch of important things that will be explained in greater detail in the gospel as a whole, giving us leitmotifs that will be developed as the symphony expands. Well, what's going on here? Well, let's see. We have an evil and mad king who kills all the boys, Jewish boys, under 2 years old, except for one who escapes. Where have I heard that before? Eyes light up. Moses, of course. Herod is playing the part of Pharaoh. Jesus is playing the part of Moses. We're presenting here the idea that Jesus is the new Moses, the new leader of God's people, the one who will be bringing people out of Egypt and into the promised land. And in case you missed it, Matthew is not above hitting you over the head with it. When Joseph gets the dream to come back from Egypt, the gospel writer tells you that what was the Lord had said through the prophet might be fulfilled. Out of Egypt have I called my son. That text, of course, originally applied to Israel. Now it applies to Jesus and to the people that Jesus will gather and lead out of Egypt. Still, that helps account for Herod and the massacre in Egypt. But why these magi? And why the star? Certainly the star doesn't work as a history, does it? Nor do the magi, really. At least not the way they interact with Herod. I mean, from what we know of Herod, he was incredibly evil. But he was also not incredibly stupid. Is he likely to have let these three foreign characters leave his palace and not put a tail on them? How did they get to Bethlehem without him knowing about it? Doesn't sound likely. And notice the change in the character of the star. Up to this point, it's been an astronomical phenomenon. We saw it at its rising, something in the skies. But now it becomes sort of a GPS beacon. Mm-hmm. It sort of floats and leads them, turn right, turn left, this is it. Which they see, but neither Herod nor Herod's people see. It's beginning to be a bit far-fetched, isn't it? Well, let's look at it symbolically. We see what Matthew was trying to teach. The star, source of light that guides, puts us in mind of passages like that first passage that we read this morning, Isaiah 60. Arise, shine, for your light is come. For though darkness covers the peoples, light has shone upon Israel. And they will stream from the east and from the west, bearing gifts. This is a prophecy about the return from exile. They'll all come home from exile, laden down with gifts, as the original children of Israel left Egypt, laden down with gifts, a.k.a. booty. The light that will shine for Israel, and that will bring the other nations to follow, it will come from all the coastlands. All around. So the star says two things. The star says that Jesus is the glory of Israel, the fulfillment of the promises. It's going to be an important theme in Matthew. He's constantly quoting the Tanakh and talking about how Jesus fulfills the promises. Right at the very beginning, the book of the genealogy of Jesus the Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Luke, in his genealogy, goes all the way back to Adam and wants to stress Jesus' humanity. Matthew goes back as far as Abraham. He wants to stress Jesus' Jewishness. Matthew is perhaps the most Jewish of all the Gospels. And his community is rock-solid Jewish-Christian community. So he wants to show clearly that the light of revelation has shone upon Israel. And yet, even his community is taking in Gentile members. In fact, they're taking in more and more Gentiles and are on the verge of being swamped by them. There will soon, if there aren't already, be more Gentile Christians in Matthew's church than Jewish Christians. He wants to show that this is in accord with the plan of God. That this light that has dawned in Israel is a light of revelation for the Gentiles, quoting Isaiah again. So, he brings Magi from the east, the ultimate Gentile. They're not only Gentiles, they're astrologers slash priests slash wise men of pagan gods. And they are coming to worship. The light for Israel is now shining for all the nations. This is a part of the mystery of what it means that the Word has become flesh. Both that Jesus becomes particular flesh, Jewish flesh, of a certain woman, in a certain time, in a certain place. This is not vague, amorphous humanity. This is a real, particular human being who comes in answer to the promises that God made to Israel many centuries before. And yet, there is also a universal dimension. He's not limited to time and space, but thanks to his death and resurrection, it's now available to us all. We can all see the light. We can all follow the light. We can all become the light, no matter where we come from. This is part of the theology that Matthew was teaching when he tells this story. Like many of the other great stories in the Bible, Good Samaritan, the prodigal son, Adam and Eve. It's historically wild, but anthropologically and theologically, absolute truth. There's no factual basis for these particular events. But it teaches us important truths about who God is and about who we are. And in our tradition, we've continued to develop those themes with layer after layer of added traditions. First of all, for instance, how many wise men are there? Everybody knows there are three wise men, right? Three magi. Does it say that? No. Magi from the east arrived in Jerusalem. The Magi. The word three does not occur in Matthew's account. Why are there three of them? Well, tradition picked up the idea that there are three gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh, and said, therefore, there must have been three wise men. Well, maybe. But it's possible for two guys or four guys or 12 guys to bring three kinds of gifts. But tradition has settled on three of them. And then tradition has gone one step farther. We've even got names for them. Very unlikely to be historical. But, you know, when you tell stories, people ask questions. And when people ask questions, you make up answers. Ask my nieces. My nieces, you know, it's one of their fondest memories of their dad. They know the names of the three little pigs. Manny, Moe, and Jack. One night he was telling them that story, and they asked the question, and that's the answer he gave right off the top of his head. Manny, Moe, and Jack. In his family, that's been the name of the three little pigs ever since. Well, the names of the three wise men are not particularly important. But there's another tradition that got layered on top of that that helps develop what Matthew was saying. It shows how tradition, even though it might have gotten off track here and there, is being made essentially sound. What do the wise men look like? Well, we know. They're right here. Notice, by the way, that the shepherds and the sheep from that side have gone back to pasture. There's still shepherds and sheep over there. But here we have the wise men. Go up and take a look at that set of three statues. The one closest to you has a turban wrapped around his head. By his robes and by his skin color, he would be very much at home in the bazaars of Baghdad or Tehran, which was the East, Asia for them. I mean, in those days, they did not know about the Americas, right? Nor about Australia. They did not know about the size of Africa or anywhere near about the size of Asia. They had no contact with anything below the jungle in Africa or north of India in Asia. There were even parts of Europe like Scandinavia they didn't know about at all. But they knew there were three continents. If you look at medieval maps, you'll see how that got reflected, you know, 1,000 years later. The Mappa Mundi are called T.O. maps, because there's a circle, and then there's a T, sideways. Asia is here, Europe is here, Africa is here, and Jerusalem is square in the center. Jerusalem is the center of the world. You've got the sea to the west. To the northwest, you've got Europe. To the southwest, you've got Africa. To the east, you've got Asia. That's the world, centered on Jerusalem. And this first wise man comes from Asia, from the part of Asia that they knew about. The Near East, the Middle East, Southwest Asia, Pakistan, India. He looks the part. The gentleman in the center is African. Rich, dark skin. Dressed a little bit more civilized than you would find for the Asian or the European. Representative of a civilization that they recognized from Ethiopia. An African. And the third fellow, now you want to see, you know, historical anachronisms. This guy is very, very pale. So you can tell he's European. He's also wearing the robes of a king. And a crown that looks very much like the crown of the French king of the 14th century. Well, a little anachronistic, but it makes the point. that Jesus is worshipped by people from Asia, by people from Africa, by people from even Europe. And they would have included even the Americas and Australia and other improbable places had they known about them. Historically, not entirely accurate. Anthropologically, theologically, dead on. This is a part of the mystery of the Word become flesh. That Jesus is the fulfillment of the promises to Abraham, the promises to Israel, the glory of our people Israel. But this glory is also the light of the nations. It brings people from all over the world, from every corner of the world, from every part of the human race, to worship where He is, to know His Father, to be enlightened by His light, to follow in that light to our Father's house. Sisters and brothers, let us pray.